Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Monday version, where we talk to senior Reason editors about the news of the week. I am Matt Welch, along here with Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Just a reminder from the jump to subscribe to us, rate us, review us, write pictures, draw pictures over at iTunes, please. There's too much in the news right now, but we hope to get to, over the next 60 or so minutes, the Golden Globes, Me Too / Time's Up, our very stable genius of a president, the long fallout over Michael Wolff's new book, Fire and Fury, and not least, Attorney General Jeff Sessions' alleged war on pot. But obviously, before all of that, I got two words for you, Oprah 2020. Here are some headlines in today's newspapers. Washington Post: Meryl Streep just endorsed an Oprah Winfrey presidential run. Time Magazine: the internet is ready for an Oprah and Tom Hanks White House in 2020. And I think my favorite of them all is the LA Times, hometown newspaper of the Golden Globes. Oprah at the Golden Globes. Is she running for president? She should, they say. Catherine, since you're an inspirational television host based in Chicago, and I literally have never seen Oprah Winfrey. I've spent 49 years on this planet not watching Oprah Winfrey, not a show, not a single movie that she's been in. Zilcho. I did watch the speech last night. I have my own thoughts, which we hopefully will not get into. But Oprah 2020, what kind of world are we living in, Catherine?
It's a world that would be better than the world we're currently living in, I guess. Once we've broken the seal on people with no experience in politics who are basically just famous and beloved of a certain subset of the population as president, sure. Oprah, sure. Why not? All things being equal.
Jenny McCarthy as Health and Human Services, or Dr. Phil.
Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz would be in the cabinet, no doubt. Judge Judy, probably. Like, let's just populate the whole thing from daytime lineups. I think that Oprah should not be president because there are lots and lots of people who actually know how to do policy and politics and have been learning those skills for their whole lives, and Oprah is not one of them. Again, if we're trading Oprah for Trump, sure thing. Let's do it tomorrow.
Suderman,
I want to jump in because this is it's really under my skin here. It's, you know, Oprah, first off, the reason why I mentioned Jenny McCarthy, Dr. Oz and Dr. Phil is because they all had large showings on her TV show. Dr. Oz and Dr. Phil were essentially their creations of her. And she's a fraud when it comes to, what Catherine's saying, like she just doesn't have.
She's not a fraud when it comes to being Oprah.
Experience.
She's just not a politician.
She's great at ratings. She's great at ratings. No, but I'm saying she's also a faker. Like her show, and I like Oprah. This isn't even really a criticism of her, but she has paraded and celebrated and launched the careers of massive frauds on the public. So she's like Trump. She's more agreeable. I probably agree with her more. I like the fact that she ran a marathon and that she battles her weight, whereas Trump has clearly given up. But for fuck's sake, you got to be kidding me. And I also want to talk about her speech. You know, this is like a bait and switch where we're talking about Hollywood and we're talking about in the past two or three or four months, stuff has come out that is specifically about Hollywood in the 1990s, in Hollywood in the 1990s and the 2000s. And Oprah's speech is incredibly moving, and it is about a woman who was raped during the Jim Crow era in Alabama. And it's like, sorry, Hollywood, this is on you. Like, you don't get to criticize Alabama in the 40s.
I think
when everything is going on is like right now, and it's like, you know, there is a shoes keep dropping, you know, on Hollywood people. Clean up your own industry at your own awards, you know, dinner and stuff like that. It's very infuriating.
I think everybody gets to criticize Jim Crow South anytime they want. Like, that's always a perfectly solid staple.
Yeah, so you leverage Harvey Weinstein.
We're anti-Jim Crow South.
Harvey Weinstein.
But I also do think there's a distinction between, I mean, this is something that we're talking about, and I think we'll get into later in this podcast, with the Wolf revelations, such as they are, which is, character matters in this office. And I am not one of these people who thinks outsiders, citizen legislators
bad.
Are always
I'm
better.
Go with
I
it
especially
bad.
Don't think that about the presidency. And so for that reason, I'm skeptical of Oprah. But I do think she would be doing things in a more conventional manner. And I did not ever think I would be in the place where all I want in this world is a more conventional president. But I do.
Okay, so Matt started with two words. I've got four words for you. Vice President The Rock.
Yeah, well, you really, yeah.
I see the smile on your face. Nobody else here can. It's really, Catherine just lit up. That made your morning.
It did.
No, he was actually cross-examined about this. This is the state of our modern discourse. There was a picture of him looking rapturously on stage when Oprah was giving her talk.
He got a National Review cover story. He's the Mitt Romney of 2020.
I think he's like the David.
And he was
French
asked about it, and he said it was a great speech, and that he's weighing his options.
So look, it was a great speech, and that's the problem.
As soon as The Rock comes out in favor of abortion or of, allowing current abortion laws to stand, and I guarantee you he will, National Review will dump him, Peter.
Like I said, the problem was that it was a good speech. And I mean, I think it was really nicely delivered and moving.
Why is it a good speech?
Because compared to the current president, compared to the state of American political speechifying, it was delivered with some measure of intelligence and drama, which I haven't seen in a major American speech, major American politician speech. In years, certainly not since Obama was president.
Politician. I mean, you're talking about a freaking awards.
Yes, but so let me finish
here. You're talking about somebody who is deflecting attention away from the industry that she is part of, and the industry that was celebrating itself last night. And it just, the Recy Taylor story is horrifying, and it is something that everybody in the country should be ashamed of. It is not the current moment. And it strikes me, this is like, it's something right out of the South Park episode about the cloud of smug emanating from Hollywood, where you turn ongoing revelations at every level in Hollywood. And somehow we're not talking about that after all of these people came forward. And, and there are pictures of Meryl Streep, who I think is a fantastic actress,
et cetera. For all of last night.
No, we're not. I'm sorry. Like, we're talking about Donald Trump and we're talking about Oprah 2020. We're not talking about Harvey Weinstein. The Academy Award, of Arts, Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is now rethinking whether or not they should have bounced Harvey Weinstein so quickly. It's like, screw this. It's a bait and switch because Oprah's not going to be president. And Catherine, you're absolutely right. Trump shouldn't be president. He's completely inexperienced and it shows. And we don't need Oprah and we don't need Dr. Phil and we don't need Morton Downey Jr., a reanimated corpse of Morton Downey Jr.
Pissed because you think like Get Out should have won? Like, is that what this is really about?
Get Out is, Get Out. Well, and I also want to talk, I think a better meditation on Hollywood as well as on sexual assault and what is going on in the country. And again, I like Oprah and I like the lineage of, she's been very grateful to Phil Donahue, who kind of created the version of the show she perfected. I like that kind of TV. I like that kind of spectacle. It's transformative. And it's America is ultimately a better place because of Oprah's show. I'm more than willing to say that. But at the same time, it's like this is a ridiculous conversation. And I think Dave Chappelle's two Netflix specials, especially the one set in LA, is a much, much more interesting text. First off, it's longer, but it also focuses on Hollywood and talking about that in that context, which seems to me to be the first thing that you start with. And you don't immediately go to, let's get the fuck out of Hollywood and let's go talk about stuff, that happened many miles from here and many decades
ago. Oprah's speech was a perfect Hollywood moment. And that is the problem, because in Hollywood and in too much of the media and in the public, we mistake speechifying for good politics and for being good at doing the job of running the executive branch or perhaps a Senate office. And while speeches and communication are certainly part of it, and it's part of the job that Donald Trump doesn't do very well, in my opinion, it's not most of the job. And there is this weird Hollywood idea that if you can deliver a great, rousing, moving speech, you are a good president, you are a good politician. And that's why I was saying that the fact that it was a good speech is the problem. And that we think of that as a qualification. It's not nothing. And like I said, I don't think it's something that Donald Trump does very well. On the other hand, the fact that Oprah gave a good one good speech shouldn't be the sort of thing that puts her on the radar for becoming president of the United States of America.
I mean, it actually is. I think you're right. That is such a Hollywood thing, right? In the, I'm sure you could tell me where exactly in that thing about the dead cats and cheerleaders or whatever the rousing speech appears. But like, you know, that's in movies, a good speech actually is governing, right? So maybe Hollywood is confused.
Yeah, and so, I mean, what is the climax of that Aaron Sorkin, of basically every episode of The West Wing, but the Aaron Sorkin, the American president, right? The climax is a long speech in which the president defends the liberal project.
Also,
right?
Ayn Rand, FYI, but that's okay.
Right, but that's, that is the Hollywood idea of how we judge who is a good president and who isn't. That is one of the reasons why Obama was so popular. Obama gave great speeches. I enjoyed them. I think Obama did some other things well. He wasn't just strictly a good speech giver, but he became a national figure in part because he gave a good speech and then continued to give more of them. And I think that we wildly overrate speechifying and the ability to deliver prepared or sort of a semi off the cuff. It's unclear sort of whether Oprah, how much of this was memorized and staged.
Please,
I mean, most of it.
Do we really need to take this seriously? Oprah is not going to run, and Oprah is not going to.
This is what we said about Donald Trump.
And I say that living in a world where Donald Trump ran for president and is president.
Listen, Stedman Graham, Nick, no less authority than Stedman Graham says it's up to the people. She would absolutely do it. Just to insert myself a little bit, Peter, it's not just Hollywood. This is one of the classic tropes of bad punditry ever is to write that speech for them. How many Tom Friedman columns over the years have been the text of the speech that's really going to do it this time, that make us fight climate change as hard as the Red Chinese or whatever? It is a trope of bad ideas about governance that are all very performative. And to Nick's point, about Chappelle, it's actually a very personal. I was watching the Golden Globes last night, and I can't like watching, especially the pre-show on E or the red carpet stuff. I last like 5 seconds max. It's just so like nails on a chalkboard. It's like watching a dugout interview in a baseball game. It's awful. But so I was watching the Golden Globes, and the kind of like the sanctimony of it all, everyone just vociferously agreeing with one another about the enormity of the moment was too much for my increasingly rancid heart to bear. And so I flipped on Chappelle. I'd seen the previous one the night before, the special from D.C., and I watched the one from L.A. where he addresses Louis C.K. And the thing that strikes me about that, besides just how good Chappelle is right now, he's really operating on a different level, is that he's making art about this, and he's recognizing that the art and what makes compelling art is that you don't have a kind of top-down vision of this is the message that I want to convey. And watching the rest of the award show last night after I flipped back from this kind of exhilarating and dislocating attempt to grapple with what's going on in Hollywood and Louis C.K. and other things from Chappelle, and watching people treat the award-winning art last night as we have message, we delivered message. That was the kind of the startling disconnect. I mean, art should confuse you and complicate you. And what I saw last night wasn't all about that. Catherine, I wanted to,
Can I just follow up real quick on the Chappelle special? Because, the one set in L.A., he ends also by going back in time. And he talks about calling for truth and reconciliation commissions about sexual politics. Along the lines of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that were founded in South Africa after apartheid. And I really recommend everybody watch those two specials. The second one is directly on point in terms of, the Weinsteins of the world, as well as the sexual assault charges, as well as sexual harassment charges against Trump. It's amazing. And he also goes back in both of those specials, in the one set in L.A., to a 1940s memoir of a pimp called Iceberg Slim, which is terrifying. And there, it is good that we are having this conversation. Absolutely. What gets under my skin is the idea that Hollywood is setting things up because they control the means of cultural production to start making this about everything else other than Hollywood. And in fact, what I think is worth thinking about, and Catherine, in your editor's note in the most recent issue of Reason, where you talk about why it's so hard to get the pervs out of politics, we need to recognize that in many ways, not in all ways, but that, you know, politics and the entertainment industry are among the last places that have been changed by an ongoing revolution or transformation of the workplace and of gender roles in America. And it just, it really bothers me that, like, Hollywood, which has been revealed as worse than most people thought. Certainly, you know, you'd have to go back to accounts from the, you know, the 30s and 40s about the casting couch and Louis Mayer and stuff like that to understand what was going on with Harvey Weinstein. And there was an entire infrastructure built up around him to protect him. And we're losing that thread, partly because of Pretty Speechifying, that allows people to get on with their careers. Meryl Streep benefited handsomely from an association with Harvey Weinstein. She says she had no idea. You know, it would be worth hearing more from her about, like, why she didn't know and how she didn't know, because it seems like it was an open secret.
Catherine, there are a lot of different moments, and I think there's more addressing of the of Hollywood as Hollywood in this than Nick's bilious take is would indicate. Just in that, you know, there was Natalie Portman. I think there was a Best Director award as she was announcing, and she says, "And the all male finalists are." And there was lots of talks about gender or pay disparity, specifically on those two points. Which I saw a lot of vigorous high-fiving, a lot of shoulders just going out of joint with the high-fiving of Natalie Portman for sticking it to them by pointing out that the five directors for Best Picture were all male. And, you know, Gina Davis going up and talking about pay disparity there. And there's some red carpet moments, too. When that happens, you have your lady hat, and you also have your ruthless, heartless kind of science libertarian hat. As we were talking before this phone call was recorded, you identify with the Tin Man, Wizard of Oz.
I do. He's my spirit
because
animal.
Because he has no heart. How do you absorb 3 hours of those kinds of messages from the stage of the Golden Globes?
First of all, I definitely don't. I don't watch award shows precisely for that reason. Second, the libertarian hat's a fedora. Is the lady hat a pussy hat? And could we combine a pussy hat and
yes.
a fedora in some way?
A pussy fedora.
A pussy fedora.
A fedora.
A fedora. As
Podesta,
it shall be.
A Podesta.
As long as you're wearing a red dress shirt with a white tie.
You got it. No, I have to wear all black because hashtag me too. Right. So, I actually do think one thing that's been pretty interesting is to watch people try to figure out what the relationship is between doesn't it suck that dudes are rapey at work with... oh, hey, no, ladies are in charge of things. Maybe it's because dudes are rapey at work. And that's, of course, an insane oversimplification. But I think it's less of an oversimplification in Hollywood, if I had to guess. I think because the casting couch is so embedded in the culture and because there is because it's a series of extremely high stakes bets predicated on relatively little actual hard data, right? This is not the same thing as selling accounting software. There is a point at which you just kind of have to be like, I don't know. Probably America's ready for two movies about asteroids hitting Earth or whatever. And I think those things people tend to prefer to make those bets on men, and the people who tend to prefer to make those bets are men. So they give each other the money and the power to do that sort of thing. I actually do think that we are probably headed into a moment now where we equate having an all-male panel with actual sexual harassment, and that's not going to be a good moment, right? Like, I've been on plenty of panels where I was the token lady and also the least qualified person on the panel, and that's not where we want to end up. That might be a stepping stone to get us where we want to end up, but in the meantime, I think we should be careful not to say putting together a panel that has all men is the same thing as literally shoving someone up against a door and grabbing their tits.
On the other hand, Hollywood has
traditionally... You do want to say that, Peter?
On the other hand, said Peter, isn't it the same thing?
Let's take hands out of this statement in all ways. I'm chopping my arms off right now and replacing them with cybernetic cocktail shakers. On the other hand, historically, the director's chair is the place where women have been found least in Hollywood. It's not the issue isn't even that all five men were nominated. It's that if you look at which directors have gotten money, especially for big projects in with the studios over the years, it's just wildly, wildly weighted towards men.
Peter, do you know who the first woman to be nominated as best director is?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
And what decade?
I'm not a big Oscar trivia database.
Yeah, was the Italian director Lena Wertmuller for Seven Beauties, I believe. Either that or Swept Away in the 70s. And it's stunning that Catherine Bigelow, I believe, is the only female director to win an Academy Award for Best Picture, which
correct.
Is not necessarily their best director. Penny Marshall is one of these early trailblazers, TV's Laverne, who has, you know, whose career faded much quicker than if she had been a male director, almost certainly. But it's not an accident. And I don't think it's simply because, there is a bias in Hollywood against female directors. There absolutely is. And you see it in every awards program ever.
And directors in Hollywood, directors are the chief creators. And that's, there was a fight, through the 40s and 50s about who was going to be the author of the film, whether it was going to be the producer or the director or the screenwriter. And the directors won. And the directors are the people who they get credited with authorship of the film. It's a film by Martin Scorsese or Quentin Tarantino. It's a film by Catherine Bigelow. And so even though there are women are somewhat better represented, not particularly well, but somewhat better represented in producers, the ranks of producers and in the ranks of screenwriters, it's the directors who control sort of ultimately what a film feels and looks like. And that means that there are just very few few women's perspectives that have gone into making films. And that's one of the reasons I think that the movie industry has in the last couple of decades gone even more all in on basically making movies for 15-year-old boys. That is the target audience. There has been a little bit of a kind of movement away from that in the last couple of years. And you see things like Wonder Woman and Beauty and the Beast doing really well at the box office this year. But basically, Hollywood's business model has kind of narrowed and narrowed and narrowed until the primary thing
Hollywood,
that they do,
films.
The studio, this films. The major studios and their biggest budget productions, the tent poles that support the entire slate for the year, are basically films aimed at me, which, I mean, in some ways, I love superhero movies and science fiction
revealed
movies.
Revealed exclusively
action,
here for the first time, Peter Superman is a 15-year-old boy.
I'm now just a little bit too old, but I'm pretty much the target audience.
But here is the thing also, to put it in a different context and a more hopeful one, I think. One of the things about last night and the Golden Globes is good because it's not simply about movies. It's also about TV and a bunch of other. I guess it's TV and movies. How many of the shows were done for things like Netflix and Amazon and whatnot? Hollywood is actually it's a declining share or Hollywood. The big movie studios is a declining share of what people are watching. They've had a flat year. There is no question that movies do not loom as large in the American public imagination as they did in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, or even in the 70s, probably. Broadcast TV is dying. These are all extremely conservative, slow-moving, failing institutions. They're the dying light. We're seeing the dying light of dead stars. And the action is in places like, first off, places like Netflix and Amazon Studios. And, of course, Amazon bounced its chief for sexual harassment not too long ago, but it's there and it's on places like YouTube and it's in different formats. And I think that's good. And I think when you look at stuff like that, the further you go away from the white hot center of old Hollywood, the more, and to call it diversity isn't even quite getting at it, just the more interesting and the wider range of products and experiences you see reflected in what's actually coming in and what people are watching.
I do want to put my fedora on, though, for a quick second here and say that, there is some self-selection in here, right? This is not just bias at work, although the bias, I think, is powerful. It's also true that being a director of a major motion picture is like a big, dumb, risky thing to do. And men do big, dumb, risky things at higher rates than women. It's not to say there aren't women who would like to do it, who are qualified, who should be able to. That's the bias bit. But there's also just it is the structure of this sort of thing that there are going to be more men in the pool and they are going to take bigger risks to get that prize.
But it's also the structure that Hollywood has decided that women are a difficult audience to reach, and therefore right. we should not try to reach them. Basically because us women over 25 in particular tend to have kids and it's harder to get them out of the house to go to a movie, right?
That's why the book market is targeted toward us, right?
Right. And a lot of the prestige television market is much more skewed towards women over 25.
Here, you know, but also in the 30s and 40s, the top, you know, many of the top box office stars were women, and women's pictures did better than men's pictures or general pictures. The one thing that is constant in Hollywood throughout its entire history, and here I'm talking about major movie studios, is a lack of women, a relative or a vast lack of women in managerial, administrative, director, and even producer roles, even though they're more represented there. So, yeah, you can call it bias. And also, Catherine, I got to say, like, you know, a risky thing is like diving, that guy from Red Bull who jumped off, you know, from outer space on a parachute into Earth, doing Justice League or releasing Green Lantern. It's stupid, but it's not that kind
Justice
of
Justice League was
I,
stupid.
I mean,
I'm
I,
with
I
you.
I think.
Let's shift gears to entertainment and tabloid personalities to President Donald Trump, and who's the subject. He's sort of the cipher, the subject in the middle of Michael Wolff's new, very controversial incredibly best-selling book that President Trump has been doing vast amounts of publicity for, Fire and Fury. Peter, I want to start with you, since you wrote about this last week, and also since you live in Washington and you hang out with the type of people who are obviously the problem in America. Can you give us just sort of a sense of how is this book landing in Washington, D.C., among your shitty 30-year-old journalistic friends?
Some of them are as old as 38 or even 41. The book is landing with a sort of, people are talking about it a lot because it is being talked about a lot on cable news. And I think part of what this book has done is package a lot of the kind of behind the scenes discussion about the Trump administration and the erraticness of the president himself and the chaos of the internal organization, especially in the first 6 months before basically all of the kind of early staff, not quite, but much of the early senior staff was let go and replaced. And the understanding, basically everyone in Washington who talked to anybody who was working with these people, whether these were people who were inside the White House, whether they were folks on the Hill, and I'm talking about Republicans too, people who outwardly are quite supportive of the president. Basically, the understanding universally was that Donald Trump is just not suited for this job, that he is erratic, that he has a hard time making decisions and having like a sensible decision making process. And that even more than that, people would describe him, the term I heard often was as difficult to brief, which is to say that they can't get him to focus and concentrate on information. And that is, in large part, what the president does is get information inputted and then make a decision or set up a decision-making process as a result. And Trump's just not very good at doing that. And he's the kind of person who has never been very good at doing that. And the presidency is all of that. So it is really overwhelming his already kind of limited capacity to do so.
Can I just actually ask, do you think that this is a modern model of the presidency, or was that always the case? Like, the idea of the president as a machine who turns briefing books into governance seems like it's a familiar description of how I also think of the president now, but surely not always.
It's somewhat new, and it comes with Congress largely abdicating its responsibility to be Congress. And this is the sort of the flip side of the Trump story is that a big part of the reason that Trump is such a problem is that the modern federal government is built to operate around the president rather than with Congress supporting the president, or if the opposite parties in control in Congress kind of opposing and playing, you know, sort of a political game. And that's a problem, is that Congress has largely given up its responsibility to be a co-equal legislative branch with powers and checks of its own. And when you put someone like, you can see, I mean, you can go back and you can see these problems in the Bush administration with all of the, you know, sort of all the executive power that Bush took that was unusual. Then you can see it even more in the Obama administration. And then when you end up with someone like Donald Trump, who is not just there to exploit the system and to take more power as Bush and Obama did, but is there, you know, in a way to, like, who isn't able to kind of competently and coherently function in that system, then you end up with, I think, a real problem. And it is a problem that is not just specific to Donald Trump. It is a problem to the way the branches have conducted themselves and the amount of power that we have allowed over the years to accrue in the executive branch.
The specific model of saying, you know, what we really need is a president who can master policy details and make snap decisions and quick decisions based on briefings. That goes all the way back to Bill Clinton, you know, because that, and Matt, you'll recall this, that, you know, he was the smart guy. He was the study, a Fulbright scholar and all of this. And, you know, he understood. He got into the weeds and the details. Reagan, of course, was famously asleep and had to be reintroduced to his lesser cabinet officers or secretaries every time he met them, yet did pretty well. I want to push back, Peter, on what, you know, you make a very coherent argument and a logically consistent and internally consistent one. Last week or 2 weeks ago, you had to grant that Trump's first year wasn't so bad. The fact that I think that, you know, Trump has debased what was left of American political discourse. And, you know, he took it and like threw it into a subway tunnel and ran over it and buried it even deeper, lowered the bar tremendously. Michael Wolff's book is part and parcel of that debasement. This is a completely anonymously sourced bullshit book that where every possible rumor gets thrown into the book. And then it's like, oh, and now we can finally talk about rumors. I mean, this is not journalism. There are a bunch of stories in it that have already been, you know, that had already been recounted and tried in the press and found to be unsubstantiated rumors about various things. It's the whole predicate of the book is that the mainstream media, which has been reporting on Trump in very critical and often overblown, but often insightful terms, are just access whores to, you know, and so that you need somebody like Michael Wolff, who will talk to anonymous people and air every kind of story. This is a version of the P dossier writ large. And while it may be true, parts of it may be true, we have to understand, like, if we take a step back, Trump is an idiot. Trump is not fit for the office. He didn't have the experience. He doesn't have the cast of mind. His first year was not, you know, contra Andrew Sullivan, was not a disaster. It is awful, and he does a lot of things I wish he would not do, and I wish other politicians wouldn't do. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the wheels didn't come off. We are not at more, you know, it is not a disaster. And in fact, certain things are going incredibly well. So we need to, like, take back, like, who cares what, you know, if Trump is watching guerrilla fights. You know, and that's part of the Wolf revelation.
Which he wasn't.
You
know, no, which, it's not. It wasn't. Spoilers. He wasn't. But man, yeah.
Okay.
That's
so
the greatest tweet, at least in 2018.
I conducted
keep it in mind.
I conducted
the
guerrilla
test. We're
in a hysterical
moment of anti-Trumpism, and it's partly because Trump is doing things differently. We all agreed that the government was broken. That's why Trump got elected. And it's not saying he's good, but it's like, yeah, you know what? These agencies continue to function. The government continues to function. DACA, for instance, that's in Congress's lap now. Congress can fix that if they spend 5 minutes doing their job. This is not all about Trump, and we need to make sure that we're not just slip sliding into a kind of anti-Trump hysteria that is exactly what we were, I think we were admitting a couple of weeks ago was overblown.
Catherine, you had some tasty Twitter reactions to Andrew Sullivan's New York Magazine piece. And in addition to elucidating on that, maybe you can also address if Peter's setup is correct. Is it not possible that the solution to that problem is an incompetent president?
So, you know, I think Andrew Sullivan's take on it is reflective of a lot of people's attitudes. And he did a piece in New York Magazine where he basically said, Trump's first year has been a disaster. This is why I still have hope. And I actually think what Nick is saying is right. Trump's first year has actually not been a disaster. It's, you know, we've muddled through. But here's why we should still be afraid. Like, that's the actual right take on this. And again, not because we're hysterical. I think this is actually of the humans in the world. The four people on this podcast have a relatively low hysteria factor. I'm not going to say zero. But there's, you know, the reason that we are obsessed with this question of Trump's character and his ability to perform what we see as the basic vision of the office in the 21st century is because it feels like a high variance time. And so even though things kind of went okay and we made it to the end of the first year, one thing could tip the wrong direction next time around and someone with a shaky hand on the tiller, right? Sailing. I can do the boats. Is going to capsize us. See how that metaphor fucking worked? That was amazing.
Yeah, nice. Good.
Slow clap for that.
Slow clap.
There's a storm brewing and there's waves.
There's a bomb cyclone coming from North Korea or something. So I guess I just think it is perfectly reasonable to be calmly hysterical about Donald Trump, to say, listen, actually, his agencies are doing good stuff. And I like me some Scott Gottlieb. I like all the Scotts. Let's have Scott Pruitt, too. Any Scott is welcome to come by and be in charge of an agency. But
Scott Shackford.
Scott Shackford should definitely run some things. And it is still also appropriate to say we should be very worried and we should be having a national conversation about whether the Gorilla channel is real. By the way, I tested this on my husband, who is not generally plugged into the minute-to-minute political conversation of D.C. I read him the Gorilla passage and he fully assumed it was real. Had he been on Twitter, he would have smashed that retweet button so hard.
Now, the way you know that it's not real is that they built a satellite transmission tower on the White House lawn.
But that shouldn't be the way we know it's not real. That shouldn't be the way we know it's not real. There should be a lot of other ways to know that story is not real.
But that would have been the only chyron in every airport and travel center, like on every cable news would have just been nothing but Gorilla Channel satellite transmission on the White House lawn.
In my mind, it's also definitely just made.
Aren't we supposed to say that, like, look, while he's watching gorillas, at least he can't be, spending money?
Well, I support pirate radio.
Let's actually
say Jesse
follow
Walker
up on that, Nick.
Definitely built it on the lawn of the White House for him using, like, a ham radio and a wire hanger.
There's reporting out over the weekend, Nick, that Trump's schedule is essentially he starts his day at 11 and he closes it at 6 p.m., preferably with a cheeseburger on the bed, as the scurrilous gossip from Michael Wolff would have it. But that he has this incredibly compressed day and not much happening there, and that he watches TV 48 hours a day. Do you see any problem with that? I see kind of some solutions there.
I'm not one of those libertarians who, pretends to be libertarian, but then kind of, prefers anarchy. So, like, I want a government that does certain things.
Every
and
podcast,
does them well.
Man. You can be both.
Trump is terrible.
They're two great tastes that together. Libertarianism and anarchy.
Catherine Mangu Ward, the world's only technocratic anarchist.
They're actually not. Because if taxation is theft, then the government is immoral and it should be overthrown. Having said that, it's again,
you want to come to my meeting,
by results. We judge by results, not by intentions. I agree. And this is a question that I think, Catherine summed up well, and it's implicit in what Peter was talking about, is Trump, are we just getting lucky because he hasn't hit the right combination of buttons on his,
jitterbug phone,
PlayStation or something that will trigger a nuclear launch? Or is it that he actually is less powerful than we think, in terms of, the ship of state and like really, pushing us into a war or anything like that? There are people around who are acting as checks and balances. It is not uncommon for an early failing or flailing presidency to fire a lot of senior advisors who actually got him into the office, especially if they're outsiders and things like that. So far, he's a mediocre president. We've had better economic growth under him than we had under Obama. Maybe that's because of Obama, maybe not. And he's deregulating a lot of stuff. is it so bad? And it's like, he is horrible. It is an embarrassment, and it's frustrating to watch him talk, to see him tweet and all of that. So what?
I think there may be a little bit of a lesson here, in at least in the domestic part of the job, the domestic economy part, which is that the best thing you can do for the domestic economy as a president is to ignore it. And we don't obviously want it to be ignored.
Are you saying the government is best that governs least?
Possibly. Right. And we don't obviously want it to, ideally, it is not ignored in the Trump way, which is sort of that he has erratic opinions. And according, at least according to Wolf's book, was like, why can't we just have Medicare for all cover everybody? Which of makes sense, given that Trump has praised single payer and universal coverage systems during the, you know, on the campaign trail, and has said, I'll never cut Medicare and Medicaid.
By
right?
the way, isn't that Bernie Sanders who we take seriously?
But the point is,
or not we, but I mean,
Trump
people do. That's his plan.
Didn't try to do an awful lot. He cut spending on Obamacare promotions, and signups were nearly the same as the year before. Right. Cut spending by 90% of the Obamacare advertising budget. He put some people in charge of the agencies who, you know, we kept hearing that Ajit Pai and Scott Gottlieb were going to like ruin America, and like it was just going to be chaos and anarchy, and Catherine was going to love it. And in fact, and she kind of does love it. So maybe actually it's no. But like it's in a lot of ways, it's fine. And my worries are much more about what happens when we get to a real acute crisis where important decisions have to be made quickly by a small group of people in the White House. And we haven't gotten to that point yet, and I hope that we don't. I think actually Ross Douthat wrote a very good column on this, basically saying, asking whether the American system of government is just sort of able to handle a president who isn't able to handle the job better than a lot of us thought. And at least in the first year, the answer is yes so far. But that's in part because the crisis hasn't, you know, the really big crisis that you worry could happen at any point hasn't come along.
And this has actually been the thing I've sort of said for a long time about elections before this one, is everyone gets hysterical. If my guy loses, the world will end. And I have for many years said, listen, the American system is pretty robust. It's also pretty sticky. You know, it's inelastic. It's hard to move. So it doesn't matter so much which person wins within our sort of basic political Overton window. It's going to be the same ish. And I think Trump's election undermined my baseline position there somewhat, but Trump's first year has shored it back up a bit. And I get why some of the alarm levels might be turning down slightly, but I do think the reason we are now just absolutely perseverating, obsessing about this question of judgment is because of the it's not even a black swan, but just a single high stakes, high risk situation that could happen.
One of the things that the administration can do, is doing, threatening to do, is that it has an attorney general who has some ideas that are very antithetical to basic human freedom. Last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who's an old-fashioned kind of drug warrior, rescinded some of the memos, the guidance given by the Obama administration about how to prioritize prosecutions related to marijuana in states where marijuana is legal, either medically or recreationally. Nick, I want to start with you on this and posit a little bit that there is in America, as you and I have written about in various fora, kind of a pendulum effect or a slingshot effect. So here's my hypothetical. Jeff Sessions, who did not in this memo direct his Justice Department or his U.S. attorneys to go out and prosecute new cases. He just rescinded old ones and reminded them that they have discretion. And there's been a pretty robust set of outraged responses from Cory Gardner, a senator, a Republican from Colorado, and other people. Is it possible that Jeff Sessions doing this will create the slingshot effect of, hey, maybe legislators will actually do something about this for not once, but maybe for twice?
Yeah, no, I think there's something to that. And, you know, first, I want to correct you, though, Matt, when you say Jeff Sessions, you know, his particularly his views on marijuana are an affront to human decency. Actually, the more correct version is that Jeff Sessions is maintaining exactly the same position towards marijuana, policy that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton had while they were in the Senate. And this isn't whataboutism.
Which is an affront to human decency. That position.
Yeah, I agree. No, but it's because he does not have a libertarian perspective. It took Obama well into his presidency to start coming around on medical marijuana and really crack down on federal prosecutors going after dispensaries in places like California. And it's really important because this is not, this can't be something where it's like, it's Republicans versus Democrats and stuff like that. The fact of the matter is, up until very recently, both parties were terrible on marijuana. That issue is over. And Matt, I do think that you're right, that what we're seeing here is that to the extent that Jeff Sessions, who did not reprioritize marijuana prosecutions and marijuana prohibition at the federal level, it will create more grounds for a wider acceptance of this for a variety of reasons. And I do think it's like a slingshot. And to go back to Dave Chappelle, because like I really think that Dave Chappelle is not simply by far and away like the best comedian ever at this point. Like the last couple of Netflix specials that he's done, or rather the last four, but especially the last two. But he talked in one of them about how things like the murder of Emmett Till, the lynching of Emmett Till, was a horrible tragedy that should never have happened, but it also had a positive effect. And he's drawing on a Christian heritage of what's called the happy fall, the idea that it's a terrible tragedy that Christ was crucified and killed, but it ultimately is a good event because it gives us a current moment where we can be saved. I think something similar is going on with Jeff Sessions and marijuana here. This is a vague last stand that will help push forward an understanding that we are a post-prohibition America. And we're going to, it's not just, the question is, we're already working past marijuana. It's what comes next. And that is unclear at the moment. But I think ultimately Sessions doing this half measure is all good for marijuana legalization because everybody with a brain, not even with a heart anymore, everyone with a brain realizes that we have been locking people up for no good reason for decades, if not longer.
Is this officially Peter, the Wizard of Oz episode of the podcast? Because we now have,
yes.
If I only had a brain, if I only had a heart, could we get some courage somewhere?
Yes, here's my courage question.
And some Peter, red shoes, ruby red slippers.
I am wearing those.
When will the cowardly lion, otherwise known as the Democratic Party, recognize that this is a winning issue? Will it be when its public approval is at 90% for legalizing marijuana? I mean, we're at 61% we're closer to 2/3 now of American public. And those trend lines are kind of decisive looking, like it turned the corner in the way that sort of interracial marriage and gay marriage that seemed to turn the corner. Knowing Democrats as you do, are they ever going to say, this is obvious?
They will, but not with current leadership. And I think there's a bunch of reasons, but I'll give you the one that I think is in some ways the most important and underrated. They're old. The Democratic leadership is older than shit.
I can't believe we made it this far into the podcast without generational warfare.
No, they're so they are reanimated corpses who have been. And it's also true, it's to some extent on the Republican side, and you just sort of in the Senate in general. This is the oldest Senate ever, and our political class is just aging. And right now, we have sort of. It is holding the country back in some important ways, and it is causing confusion and problems in terms of legislation and in terms of sort of thinking about new technologies and things like pot legalization. And it is just very difficult to see the sort of the Obama, Bush, Clinton era folks who have come up in Democratic leadership deciding, yes, let's go full bore on this. And so it's going to take a transition because people under 40, 45, 50 have basically come around on this. And it is the old guard and the old folks and the people who vote for the old folks who are mostly old people themselves. Sorry, I love you old people. You're great. But it's time to legalize the marijuana and you're kind of standing in the way.
Preach.
Catherine, well, just to follow up quickly, there's two things I would recommend. One is Saturday Night Live not long ago had a pretty funny bit where they had a bunch of people impersonating senior Democratic leadership, all kind of looking in the camera and saying, We're the wave of the future. And it was emphasizing that they're all like old as death at this point.
Bernie Sanders is like the Crypt Keeper. I mean, he has more energy. He's not as funny. Right? Like, he's the freaking future of the party. Really? Like, I mean.
I'm looking at Pew research numbers on support for pot legalization by age. And boomers, it's 56%. Millennials is 71%. Only the silent generation is below 50%.
The silent generation should shut up about pot and let us smoke it.
Annoying. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. You'll be all happy to know. So I was for reasons we need not get into. I was looking around, thinking about
you were high AF over the weekend, Matt.
Yeah, so I was thinking, I wonder if John McCain is the last Vietnam veteran in the Senate, because he's old and he's obviously ailing, and he's
does Dick Blumenthal, who lied about it, count?
He does, at least according to the website that I found. There's 11 out of 100. The Vietnam War ended in 1975, so you would have to have been at least 18 years old in 1975. That ain't young. This is super not young, but there's 11 Vietnam vets there. Catherine, are we going to legalize this before President Oprah takes her oath of office?
No, I think we're going to legalize 5 minutes after the beginning of the next administration, if I had to guess. That there will be two rounds of ballot initiatives between us and the next administration, and a bunch of states are going to be like, Jesus Christ, let's just at least get ourselves ready for this transition, which is inevitable, and then it won't happen on the federal level till we have another upheaval.
What is Oprah's position? I don't want to play it, but there's a TMZ video that says, does Oprah smoke weed? I'll vote for Oprah if she. I don't give a shit what she talks about if she would just legalize weed, and
wow,
not even because that's
was a major reversal from the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah.
There, you've now
we're
given
talking about the slingshot effect.
You've now given credence to the theory that libertarians are just Republicans who like to smoke weed. Congratulations
about old people. Since I
actually
I bashed
them
so much, they make some good movies. Ridley Scott is 80 years old and released two movies this year. He's not on Twitter. He's productive.
Yeah, he is. All right. Well, let's round third base heading to home. And I think I said that exact same thing last time. So according to Michael Wolff, that's what you do when you're old. You just repeat the same story several times within a 10-minute
Matt, do you want to call this session or you should call your podcast Inside the Park?
Oh, yes. Inside the Park. So
once again, you are not allowed to name podcasts.
Yes.
Podcast names are even worse than those places where you can do cheap ceramics, you know, that are always called like You're Fired or Get Fired, Fired Up, or haircutting places.
Trying to tether this thing into
the podcastery.
Stop. Please stop.
Jesus Christ.
You've just broken this like a vase over my head.
Nick, what could happen good under Trump presidency this year? Looking into just like policy, it's not as bad as we thought. It could be as good or bad. We all know nuclear war and a red button with North Korea could happen. So give us something positive that could happen that's sort of new and surprising this year or in the near future with this Trump presidency.
So, I mean, you know, the whole DACA thing, you know, the Dreamer portion of immigration reform is in front of Congress right now. Trump has stayed, you know, his deportation stuff. And he, you know, obviously assisted by the fact that it may or may not be fully legal. Obama did the DACA stuff, you know, where he kept people who were brought here illegally by their parents when they were minors. He gave them certain exemptions from deportations, certain stays. Trump wanted to get rid of them. He wanted to get rid of them immediately. He has given it back to Congress to make a law that, you know, would satisfy various kinds of concerns. That's, to me, that is something that could be good, where Congress could say, you know what, we're seeing a net drain of Mexicans out of the country. The idea that we're going to spend a lot of money building a wall with, you know, on the Mexican border is stupid, as is most of Donald Trump's immigration rhetoric and preferred policy. And we are actually going to allow people who were brought here illegally as minors, who have shown themselves to be good and upstanding Americans, to stay here. And we may even get around to not only giving them work permits, but giving them a pathway to citizenship. And that's the small version of it. And that is a genuinely popular, it is a genuinely libertarian, and it is a genuinely humane thing to do. I think that could happen, and it could happen very quickly. It's going to have to happen.
In USA Today, today, Mark Krikorian, rip off the Band-Aid and give them a green card. I know. That's where we are now. Right. Apparently, there the DACA pivot is so far underway.
A man, an Albanian American.
Well, now, wait a second.
If is he Armenian? He must have Armenian, excuse me. Yes, he's Armenian, which is possibly even worse than being Albanian. But no, Mark Krikorian, or I like to pronounce it Krikorian, because that's how I think American English would do it. He's always been against immigration to the extent that he's saying, let anybody stay. That's a sign of an iceberg melting.
Catherine, what good thing could happen this year that's plausible emanating out of the Trump administration?
Well, I mean, I already, if Mark Krikorian has said the phrase, give them a green card, that's enough for me, that we can just go ahead and check off 2018. But no, I think the other good thing that can happen will be the domestic policy stuff that we've been talking about. This is, you know, we were asking about Trump's short day of work. I, for many years, have championed the Calvin Coolidge model of the presidency, which involves a nap every afternoon. So if continued
Coolidge, also very anti-immigrant, he happily signed all of the immigration restrictions that were put in front of him in the 1940s.
Well, you know, immigrants are lazy. That's why we don't want them to come in. They take naps in the afternoon, I hear.
Yeah. All my faves are problematic. I get it. But still, I think a neglectful Trump for the next year of domestic policy, particularly on the FDA front, medical devices, in particular, that would be that I anticipate that actually happening. I think it will be good to deregulate those things. Also, I think inaction on the perceived opioid crisis is almost certainly our best case scenario. So I'm going to say inaction on the opioid crisis is a good thing that I hope for in the coming year.
Suderman, do you have anything positive to put in your crystal ball about the Trump administration in the Lord's year 2018?
The immigration stuff that's been mentioned. But no, I mean, really, I think the best hope for the Trump administration in an election year is that some deep-pocketed media backer, venture capitalist out there, launches a guerrilla channel and that we get that.
Only the fighting parts, though.
Is it gorillas or is it all of the upper primates? And I hate to.
I mean, I think to fill out 24 hours a day.
Jeez, you racist.
You know, it's going to have to be like the second of the new Planet of the Apes movies where, you know, they start a colony and they put their like first commandment on the wall and human blood and it's ape, not kill ape. Right. And, you know, they're all going to live together in happy harmony.
It's an expanding circle,
and
though. And finally, by the end of the first year, there'll be a Big Brother house with apes and humans.
I don't watch reality television, but I do watch bad action movies. And so if we don't get the Guerrilla Channel, my second hope for a Trump administration is that he lives up to the promise of this great 1997 New Yorker profile of him, which had a moment in which the profile writer is on Trump's private plane and Trump starts watching some like crappy Oscar bait movie or something and then decides it's boring and puts in Bloodsport. The Jean-Claude Van Damme Bloodsport film, but tasks his son with fast-forwarding through all of the exposition so that he only has to watch the really awesome action sequences. He tells the reporter, you know, I'm just trying to get this two-hour movie down to 45 minutes. And so I hope that Trump learns Adobe Premiere and how to edit video and spends his executive time eating cheeseburgers and producing a Trump-authorized presidential cut of Bloodsport. Action scenes only. I think that would be a great accomplishment for any president.
That's by the way, how I've watched both John Wick movies is just people doing that with the murders
But then there's movies like Burt Reynolds' Malone, where it's better to fast forward through the fights and then just go through the exposition where he mentions that his name is Malone at least 600 times in about 6 minutes.
I will end with something that I don't plan on betting on at all, but I just don't want to give up hope yet. The president is very keen on signing an infrastructure bill. There are a lot of people in place at the Department of Transportation, even at the relevant congressional committees, who have good ideas, by which I mean they agree with Bob Poole, a longtime American hero and Reason Foundation transportation policy expert. I almost made those
transportologist.
One word. Yes. Most likely they're going to sign a lousy bill that spends way too much money, but it's possible that, I'm dreaming of a world in which Chuck Schumer is convinced that it doesn't all have to come from the Department of Treasury and that they sign something that actually allows the private sector to build stuff and run stuff and so that we don't have...
And pay for stuff.
And pay for stuff. That's what I mean by build it. Like, you pay for this damn thing. I mean, the Economist magazine had a piece... recently about how, you know, America has the worst airports in the world. JFK is just in a languishing hellbath this weekend because there was, 8 inches of snow. It's embarrassing. We should do all of that so much better. And there's a lot of policy things that we could do. So it's still in the realm of possibility. I want to hope for it to happen, even though in my heart of hearts, I know that it probably won't. But that's all the dark hearted musings that we have time for. Thank you for listening to the Reason podcast. Go and subscribe to us. Double subscribe. That's possible, right? Double rainbows, double subscribe over at iTunes. And remember to write reviews and rate us with all the star mechanisms there. And stay tuned for the rest of the week as we roll out all kinds of other juicy Reason podcast interviews with various and such like. Thank you. Good night.